Hello, everyone. Welcome to Talk Nerdy. I am your host, Kara Santa Maria. And if you are listening to this episode in real time and you also keep up with me in via social media, then you may know about some crazy stuff that's been going down for the past week. If you follow me on Facebook or Twitter, you may have seen that just a few days ago, actually, I received a message through Facebook from a gentleman living in Saudi Arabia, a young man, I think early 20s, and he was concerned because he's an atheist, he's a non-believer, and his father found out, and his father threatened to turn him into the authorities. And of course, in Saudi Arabia, this would be viewed as apostasy, which is a transgression that's punishable by death. So we really felt like the situation was dire. I was really concerned about him, but didn't know what to do. I originally just said, you know, maybe you can go to the U.S. Embassy. I'm not really sure how to handle the situation. Through more research, we discovered that he has dual citizenship, that he was born in America and was finally able to get a hold of his passport. And through the combined efforts of Sarah Moorhead over at recoveringfromreligion.org, and also from Faisal Saeed Al-Muttar at movements.org, we were able to mobilize just this incredible outpouring of support and both financial and just like morale support via social media. So it just goes to show, I mean, over the course of, I want to say 48 hours, we were able to raise enough money to get a plane ticket, get this guy to safety, get him out of his house. He snuck out in the middle of the night, went to the airport, had this very long layover, but finally made it to the U.S. safely. And now he is not, you know, at risk anymore of being tried or, I mean, tried. That's I guess, a generous term by the Saudi government and potentially being punished to death for being a non-believer. So I'm very pleased. I'm really just overwhelmed emotionally with the support that you guys gave via these different social media outlets. We're not done yet. I said we were able to raise enough funds to get the plane ticket. I'm not sure if we actually have raised enough to pay the total cost of the plane ticket. I know we were able to pull some of that out of pocket and then repay. But if you are interested in helping support this cause and also other causes to help individuals who are recovering from religion, you can visit recoveringfromreligion.org and pledge your support there. We've still got a long ways to go with our Saudi friend. He's in temporary housing right now, but you know, gosh, what a big change, leaving your family behind, knowing you could never go back and really having to start from scratch. So once again, I just want to thank you all so much from the bottom of my heart. I also want to thank those of you who have supported the show this week in the many ways that you do. So let me just outline some of those ways. If you want to support the show financially, you can visit patreon.com/talknerdy and you can pledge to provide support on an episodic basis. And my episodes come out every Monday morning. So there you will be charged whatever it is that you pledge each week when a new episode posts. If you want to do a one-time kind of tip, I guess you could call it, you can go through my PayPal portal and you'll find that by visiting my website, carasantamaria.com. You can also support on a monthly basis. There's a little, I think they're called radio buttons. There's a little radio button. When you click through to the PayPal, it's the donate button on the page. And you can fill in the dollar amount. And there's a little button that says, make this a recurring payment. That's how you make it a monthly recurring payment. And I'm specifically saying this because I know that, who are you? Craig through PayPal from Burlington, Vermont. You asked about that. So I wanted to let you know, you may have overseen it, but it's right there on that first, donate page. And yeah, so those are the three ways you can support the show financially. And here comes a shout out to those of you who did that this week. Over on Patreon, I want to thank Brian Holden, Jeffrey Sewell, and Chuck Pell for your continued support of the show. And we've got a new patron, named Timothy Glover. Thank you so much for your support, Timothy. And at the end of the month, when everything is processed, I will send you your goodie in the mail. I also want to jump over to PayPal and thank, first and foremost, oh my gosh, Trevor Drake, you are amazing. Thank you so much for the kind note. And thank you so much for the support all the way from the United Kingdom and your request to put the audio up on YouTube. That's not a bad idea. How would you recommend that I do that? Just a placeholder, image? Maybe I can. Let me think about that. All right. And let's see who else. Kevin D. Oh, no. You're using your friend's account, you said. Okay. So you said if I mention you on the podcast tonight, your name is, I really hope you're not trolling me with this because it's the most epic name of all time, but thank you so much, Beauregard Butterbarns from Charlotte, North Carolina. You rule. Thank you for your support. Thank you for your awesome name. And lastly, big thank you to Lynn Fortman. And guys, if you can't support the show financially, you don't have to. I mean, Talk Nerdy is free to download. The financial support that you folks give who can, that's amazing because you help the people who can't afford to pay for this content and keep it free for them. So a great way to show your support is just tell your friends, you know, tell your family that you learn a lot listening to Talk Nerdy, if it's true. And also, if you got nice things to say, you can go to iTunes or Stitcher. You can rate and review. That's really helpful. And oh yeah, and I sell merch on the website. I don't know if you want a cool t-shirt or something like that. I don't like hawking merch. I feel guilty about it, but it's all there and there is some cool stuff. So once again, that's all at carasantamaria.com. All right, so without further ado, I'm excited to welcome this week's guest, and I want to give you his full title because it's pretty intense. He's a professor of marketing and the Concordia University Research Chair in Evolutionary Behavioral Sciences and Darwinian Consumption. And of course, we will explain this throughout the episode. Without any further ado, here he is, Gad Saad. Gad, thank you so much for joining me and coming all the way down from the Great White North.
Well, thank you for having me.
So you are, where are you located in Canada?
So I'm in Montreal.
Montreal.
But I like to pretend that I actually live in Southern California. I used to be a professor at UC Irvine for a few years, and I have family here since the mid-80s. And so Southern California is pretty much a second home.
Nice.
But officially, I am in Montreal.
So how often do you get to come down here?
At least once a year for a large part of the summer, usually somewhere between 3 to 5, 6 weeks. And then professionally, if I have to come and give a talk or something. So, you know, once a year to 3 times a year.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
I love it here. You know, I got to admit the weather, we're already talking about the weather like 2 seconds into the show. The weather's been kind of ugh lately, but today's really beautiful.
It is.
It's nice and windy. It's been so hot. So having that breeze has been wonderful.
Well, we're based in Newport Beach. That's actually where we lived when I was at UC Irvine.
Mm-hmm.
And the weather is much more gentle in Newport Beach than it is here in the Valley. I guess, is this considered the Valley?
It's not technically the Valley, but it's so close. Like
right.
When you're in Hollywood, it's about a 10-minute drive over the hill.
Right, okay.
And then you're in the real Valley, which actually can be up to 10 degrees hotter.
Oh, yeah, wow.
But we're still far enough from the beach that we don't have that
right.
Coolness. I'm weird. I say this all the time. I've lived here for probably 6 years. I think I've been to the beach like 3 times.
What?
I know. It's such a weird Hollywood thing.
Now, where do you hail from?
I'm from Texas.
Ah, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Very nice.
So, you know, the beaches there are pretty disgusting. You go when you're a kid, but
well,
then you compare it.
I've been to Barton Springs in Austin. Are you familiar with that?
Love it.
Cold water. It's, you know, 100 degrees outside. You jump in 65-degree water. Incredible feeling.
So nice. And Austin's such a city.
It is.
It's so much fun. I actually get to go, I think, in a week or two for a shoot that I'm really excited about because I haven't been back to Austin in a long time. My folks live in North Texas near Dallas. So I almost never get a chance to go to Austin, but that's definitely, I think, the crown jewel of Texas.
It's... Well, I have a horror story from Texas if you'd like me to share.
Yes.
A few years ago, I had a sabbatical leave, and so I had organized a tour of Texas to give several talks. I had been invited to go to Texas Tech in Lubbock.
Mm-hmm. That's Tech, yeah.
And then Texas A&M, University of Texas, Austin. So the first part of my trip was Lubbock. And it turns out that I was stuck in Lubbock for about 4 or 5 days and all the other talks were canceled because there was 1 inch of snow. And that now I'm coming from Montreal and I received this urgent message saying, hey, your 2 talks today. And these were big talks. These are university-wide talks. Are canceled. So I thought, okay, there must be some sort of terrorist threat. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what is it? Oh, well, the weather. So I look outside and I said, but what is the weather? There's about half an inch of snow. Oh, but we're not used to it here.
No, we have no infrastructure for it. It's hilarious, actually, because when first of all, when it would snow, everybody would be dumbfounded. What is this white stuff falling out of the sky? And then nobody can drive. Nobody can get around. It's insane. Yeah, it was fun, though, because that meant you always got out of school. Every time it snowed, you got out of school, which was great.
Without any disrespect to Lubbock, I was happy to be out of Lubbock.
Oh, yeah. Lubbock is not the place you want to visit when you go to Texas. Ask anybody who is actually going to Texas Tech right now and living in Lubbock.
Right.
They'll agree. I wouldn't recommend Dallas either. Definitely, I would say when you go to Texas, you go to Austin or you go to San Antonio.
Right.
Best two places. Good food, good music, good nightlife, good culture. It's kind of like hipster redneck.
Right.
It's like an interesting vibe that's really fun. But so you're hailing all the way from Montreal. You're probably the third or fourth Canadian guest I've had on the podcast.
Well, I'm offended that I'm not the first.
I know. It's weird. I've seen a lot. I've had a lot of people from Canada. I've had Karen Bondar, who's from Canada, and she's a science communicator. I've had Natalie Panic, who's a rocket scientist up in Canada. I can't remember who else, but I know I've had more. And now you. And you come from a very different background.
Right.
I'm actually really excited to be talking psychology today because that was my first love. That's how I found neuroscience. Is my undergrad was psych, and then I went into more kind of brain science and behavior and the neurological underpinnings of behavior. But you took a different route, didn't you?
Should I tell you a bit about sort of how I ended up where I am?
I would love it.
So first semester as a doctoral student at Cornell, my goal was to study consumer behavior. And so my doctoral advisor at the time had said, this was fall 1990, why don't you take this advanced social psychology course with this great social psychologist, Dennis Regan, and it should be fun. So this wasn't an evolutionary psychology course. Halfway through the semester, Professor Regan assigned a book called Homicide, which is a seminal book for evolutionary psychologists. It's written by two of the pioneers of evolutionary psychology, Margot Wilson and Martin Daly, husband-wife team. Actually, they hail from Canada.
Nice.
They're from McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. And the book basically looked at patterns of criminality across cultural settings and across time periods and demonstrated that there are certain recurring patterns that occur precisely because there is a evolutionary underpinning to this, these patterns of criminality. So just to give you one or two examples. So the number one greatest threat to a woman is her long-term male partner. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, it's not the serial killer who's hiding in the tree.
Yeah, that's the random guy following you to your car.
Exactly.
That's usually somebody you know.
Exactly. And usually the trigger of violence is either for suspected or realized infidelity. Now, from an evolutionary perspective, it's easy to explain. It's not a very good thing for a biparental species where men invest a lot in their offspring to be cuckolded. Mm. And therefore, men are driven to homicidal rages if their paternity certainty is threatened.
That's fun.
Yeah. So that was one. Now, incidentally, and I'll give a second example in a second. Mm-hmm. People think that when you provide these types of explanations, you're condoning the act.
Yeah, no.
That's a common attack against evolutionary psychology. So if you explain rape or you explain violence or you explain infanticide, well, so you're coming up with justifications for it. And usually my rebuttal is the oncologist studies cancer, but he or she is not for cancer. They're not pro cancer, right?
Good point. So, but really to try and understand why people do what they do, whether it's a bad thing or a good thing, it's important to understand its origins because then maybe you can actually do work to dissuade it or to treat it. Yeah.
You can't develop proper public policy if you don't understand the true fundamental mechanisms.
This is a big problem, I think, right now, just to go off on a total tangent with addiction.
Right.
Is that oftentimes addiction is not treated in a clinical way. It's not treated in a way where we really look at the root psychological causes of addiction, the early abuses or the whatever, you know, a person is trying to self-medicate with. We often look at addiction as if it's a criminal act.
Right.
And we treat it that way, which has been devastating for public policy and for our prison system here, especially here in the States. Oh, God.
Right. But I think they're kind of softening on that, right? The harsh penalties against sort of recreational drugs and all that? No?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely there has been some recent moves. The federal government, though, I think has been not on the team that they said that they've been on. Obama was not very good early on. He really made a lot of promises that he wasn't going to go after the states where they had decriminalized things like marijuana, and yet there were still federal raids. And I think that part of the problem, you know, it gets really complicated, and I'm sure that that you've read a lot about this too, is that we have private prisons and we have mandatory minimum sentences. And until we kind of do away with both of those problems and prison is no longer a for-profit system, we're going to keep trying to put people away for nonviolent crimes.
Right.
A huge percentage of our population is in prison, like more than in any developing nation.
Right, yeah.
It's pretty rough.
Yeah, I've seen some of those stats.
Oof, yeah. But anyway. But
yeah, so to go back to the how I got to my evolution stuff. So another example from their book is the number one threat in terms of abuse to a child is if there is a step-parent in the family.
Interesting.
It's about 100-fold greater than the second, you know, best predictor of abuse. And again, the evolutionary explanation is not difficult to imagine. You take, say, a father or stepfather, he's likely to met out his investment differently depending on whether the child is biologically his or not.
Mm-hmm.
And you see this in other species. So I looked at the parsimony and the explanatory elegance in that book. And since I was interested in studying consumer behavior, I right away thought, well, gee, I wonder if I could take some of these evolutionary principles and then apply them to the study of consumption.
Mm.
And hence, eventually, I founded the field of evolutionary consumption. For many years, it was pretty much me, the lone wolf, and some of my graduate students would come in. And then eventually, about maybe 10 years into being the lone wolf, other people started to come into the field. But at first, it was very, very difficult because in the social sciences, the amount of hostility that you typically face if you try to biologize any phenomenon is quite extraordinary. So,
especially behavior.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I even probably have some lingering doubts that trickle down because that is the air when you're in a psychology department, is that the evolutionary psychologists are maybe overstepping or they're you know, that a lot of the hypotheses can't be based on hard evidence because it's very difficult to do experiments to provide evidence for some of these hypotheses.
Do you want me to tackle this one?
Because I'd love to, because I think that this is probably something that a lot of people who are either in the quote unquote hard sciences, which is always a big, terrible distinction, but in the biological sciences or in the more kind of biopsychological sciences hear echoes in the hallway.
Right. So I'll start off by saying it's utter nonsense. So anybody who says that, they're simply advertising that they really don't know what evolutionary psychology is. Evolutionary psychologists actually collect a lot more evidence to support their adaptive hypothesis than is typically the case for most of the sciences. Let me give you one or two examples. It's going to be a bit technical, so I hope that you won't lose focus with me here.
I won't, but let me dig if something loses me.
Please.
Yes.
Please interrupt anytime you want.
Great.
So there's this idea known as nomological networks of cumulative evidence. In other words, when you're trying to test an adaptive story, contrary to the typical detractors who say, oh, evolutionary psychologists come up with just so storytelling, they just hand wave. Typically, what you do as an evolutionary psychologist is you try to identify multiple lines of evidence stemming from completely different fields, all of which converge to supporting whatever it is that you're claiming.
Very similar to the way that we understand now that natural selection is the mechanism for evolution.
That's exactly right, right?
Yeah, we see it in paleontology, we see it in genetics, we see it across the board.
Perfectly right. And what Darwin did in Origin of Species was exactly that, right? There wasn't a singular piece of evidence that led him to his big breakthrough.
Mm-hmm.
It was rather many different pieces put together. Now, he didn't call it nomological network of cumulative evidence, but that's what he's doing.
Yeah.
He's basically collecting all sorts of disparate evidence, which when put together, clears the puzzle. And so let me give you one or two examples. Some of your viewers, if they've listened to me on other shows, might have heard this. Others, it might be new.
Mm-hmm.
So if I take, for example, the idea that the waist-to-hip ratio preference that men have is roughly at 0.7,
mm-hmm.
a lot of people will say, oh, but that's just so storytelling. You're coming up with this, you're hand waving. Now, let me give you a set of examples of how rigorous that's been tested. So first, if you do epidemiological studies, mm-hmm. you demonstrate that women who have roughly that hip-to-waist ratio are healthier, are younger, are more likely to bear children. So the medical link is checked. Now, if we go to many different cultures and you show them figure drawings of women possessing different waist-to-hip ratios and ask the men of these very disparate cultures, this is not running the study in your undergraduate lab at University of Texas at whatever. Mm-hmm. You actually go to radically different cultures, you find that there is convergence in terms of the types of preferences that men hold. Let's give a few more. If you look at statues spanning several millennia from mm-hmm. completely different art traditions, Egyptian art, ancient Greek art, Indian, African art, and you do a content analysis, a morphological analysis of the statues, they're roughly 0.7. I did a study a few years ago where I had, I did a content analysis of the waist-to-hip ratio of female escorts, prostitutes that mm-hmm. advertise themselves online across 48 different cultures. It was roughly 0.7. I think it was 0.72. You could take congenitally blind men. If you ever want to rule out the idea that it's all due to socialization and Hollywood images, well, you take men who've never had the gift of sight, right? So you couldn't come up with a better test. Mm-hmm. And if you then do a haptic test, so they actually touch different models mm-hmm. of different waist-to-hip ratios, guess which one they prefer, 0.7.
Interesting.
So imagine, and I could, by the way, I could give you many other lines of evidence. Mm-hmm. So now imagine the number of extraordinarily varied information that I just provided you to support the idea that 0.7 is an evolved preference. Now, I challenge anybody who's a listener to identify some hypothesis that is their preferred hypothesis where it has been put to as rigorous a test, they won't be able to. So usually the people who argue that it's a bunch of hands, they just don't know. They know pop evolutionary psychology, mm-hmm. and so then they attack that. Serious evolutionary scientists are actually quite dogged in their pursuit of evidence.
Yeah, this is very different than, you know, reading something in a magazine, especially like a women's magazine, where you say, scientists say that blah, 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 or there's a new study that, you know, hasn't been replicated. That this is very common, I think, where the media will write around a press release, exactly. and they'll write it exactly the way that the PIO wrote the press release, and then that's what you get.
Exactly.
But yeah, digging deep, it does look, I mean, it sounds right. It sounds obvious that when you have these many different lines of evidence that you're starting to get onto something. I think my question is, and it's just the first question that pops into mind, how can you really distinguish, for example, if you're looking at, let's say, multiple cultures, let's say, like you said, you know, Southeast Asian cultures, African cultures, European cultures, and maybe even some tribal cultures, there still seems to be some sort of central thread, some sort of social thread, because even though we all evolved from the same lineage, right, of Homo sapiens in Africa, that means that our cultures all evolved out of that same lineage as well. So is it important to you to tease away
right.
that right. this could just be something that's a cultural evolution and not necessarily an innate kind of
right.
biological evolution?
That's a great question. So there are some things that are human universals.
Mm-hmm.
And that we can pretty much hang our hat on the fact that anywhere in the world that you go, you're going to find. So there is no culture that's ever been uncovered, despite the fact that cultural relativists really try to uncover it, where women on average are more interested in sexual variety than men. Now, this doesn't mean, incidentally, that women are these chaste, prudes, mm-hmm. Victorian angels. Hardly that, right? There are very clear evolutionary reasons why women would also seek variety when it comes to, you know, mating. But there is no culture where, on average, women are more interested than men. That's an absolute universal fact. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's been shown by doing studies across an incredibly varied number of cultures. On the other hand, we've also evolved the capacity for behavioral plasticity. In other words, one of the adaptations that is part of our innate repertoire is the capacity to be flexible, to respond to different environmental contingencies. And therefore, The fact that culture A uses more spices in its culinary traditions than, say, culture B, that itself is a cultural difference, so it's not a human universal, but that difference is itself due to a biological problem. It turns out, for example, that this is actually a field called Darwinian gastronomy.
Fascinating. Is this, tell me if my guess is right, that in hotter climates, people use more spices?
You're an evolutionary psychologist. There, you see, that's the beauty of evolutionary theory, right? Is that even if people are not trained in evolutionary theory, as a matter of fact, many of the most famous evolutionary psychologists were not originally trained in evolutionary biology.
Sure, they're studying something else.
And then eventually they get sort of the eureka moment, as in a sense you just hypothesized about this link. That's exactly right. In hotter climates where you have greater possibility of being exposed to food pathogens, then this is a very real biological problem, which is resolved in part through different cultural traditions evolving. Mm-hmm. In this case, whether you pickle the food, whether you use more spices, whether you smoke the food, all of these culinary traditions are adaptive solutions to local niches.
Sure.
Now, if you were a cultural anthropologist, you would simply revel at cataloging the cross-cultural differences. The Malaysians do it this way, and the French eat more cheese, and the Italians do, and that's where the conversation ends. What the evolutionist does is he or she goes one step further and says, are there ultimate explanations for these cultural differences? So the true evolutionary psychologist is not only interested in human universals, he or she is interested both in culture and in biology.
And so the kind of cultural anthropologists are very helpful to you because they've cataloged much data.
Absolutely.
So you can kind of take some of the studies that they've done and dive a little bit deeper.
Exactly. And which actually, what you just said is a wonderful segue to another really important defining feature of evolutionary theory. And that's the difference between what are called proximate scientific explanations and ultimate. Have you heard this term before?
Mm-mm.
So much of science operates at the proximate level, meaning that scientists look at how a mechanism works, what are the factors that affect the mechanism. So if I'm studying diabetes and I want to understand the mechanisms of diabetes, I'm working at the proximate level. Mm-hmm. Most Nobel Prizes have been won at the proximate level.
Some sort of biochemical link that's discovered or that just perfectly underpins the problem.
Exactly. It is a description of the mechanisms of that phenomenon, whether it be a social phenomenon or a neural phenomenon, doesn't matter. The ultimate explanation, it's not ultimate, and a lot of people don't like that term. They think it's ultimate, meaning it's superior.
Yeah,
it's the
or
ultimate.
Meaning like it can never be disproven.
Exactly. That's not what it means. Ultimate means the ultimate Darwinian why. If a mechanism exists in that form, you could either study its mechanism or you could study why did the mechanism evolve to be of that form. So both levels of analyses are needed to understand any biological phenomenon. And maybe I can give you a specific example to make it more sort of palpable. So if you look at pregnancy sickness, women experience it around the world in very predictable ways. It's not called, by the way, morning sickness because some women don't experience it in the morning. So the more general term is pregnancy sickness. Now, there are all sorts of ways that you could study proximate phenomena related to pregnancy sickness. How do different smells trigger the symptoms of pregnancy sickness? How do shifts in a woman's hormonal profiles affect the severity of her symptoms? Mm-hmm. Those are all wonderful proximate navigations or explorations.
Sure.
The ultimate explanation for pregnancy sickness would be to ask the question, why would women have evolved this very predictable physiological reaction?
Mm-hmm.
Can I see if you can guess what it might be? Sorry to put you on the
spot.
No,
I think it's good. I think it's good. So why would we evolve? Yeah, why would we want to barf up all of our food if we're trying to raise a little baby and give it all of our nutrition? Maybe it's that we are, this is going to be so wrong, but I'm guessing.
Doesn't matter.
That we are more sensitive to pathogens and toxins. So because of that, our body has more like false positives.
You're almost there. Okay, so pregnancy sickness happens in the first trimester.
Mm-hmm.
During the first trimester is where organogenesis is happening. This is where the main organs of the fetus are forming. During that developmental period, it is particularly important that the mother not be exposed to food pathogens or teratogens, things that affect the developmental mechanisms. Therefore, pregnancy sickness as an adaptive solution to this problem. It's not just the barfing. So barfing, of course, expels possible, but it's also the things that women are attracted to eat and the things that they're repulsed from. So, for example, you often hear sort of the stereotype of the pregnant woman who wishes to have a pickle.
Pickles and ice cream.
Right? Well, pickles, pickling is actually part of the culinary solutions to removing pathogens,
sure.
Right? You're not attracted as much to foods that have a high pathogenic load.
Like fish.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So all of these mechanisms put together offer a great ultimate explanation. Now, this doesn't negate all of the great work that's done at the proximate level. So as I explain to people, the fact that I come with an ultimate explanation need not threaten you. Because oftentimes, social scientists think that biology boy is coming now and all of my paradigm is going to be shattered. Now, in many cases, some of the stuff they come up with is such BS that is true.
Mm.
I am going to shatter you once you understand what biology is. But in many cases, no, we could perfectly coexist. You work at proximate world and I work at ultimate world, and together we will solve this particular phenomenon.
And also, it does seem like what sometimes will happen is that an ultimate explanation will be necessary for kind of navigating the potentially the causal, you know, effects of something, but it's the proximal explanation that is more treatable.
Right, absolutely.
Because even though evolution says that, you know, or even though women, for example, adapted to stay away from certain foods, we now live in a culture with an FDA and where we're likely not going to get sick from the food that we eat. So in order to kind of trump this evolutionary hiccup, maybe the proximal explanations are going to lead to better treatments.
Fair enough. Although for that particular example, when you go to see your gynecologist complaining about the severity of your symptoms, and he or she prescribes you a pill to shut off pregnancy sickness, it's actually the perfectly incorrect thing to do.
Interesting.
From the perspective of, so you might say, well, how do you measure the success of this issue? Women who experience greater pregnancy sickness are less likely to miscarry.
Gotcha.
The health outcome of the child is better. So you're actually, notwithstanding your FDA argument, you are shutting off a mechanism that, as unpleasant as it might be, is really there to protect the fetus.
And of course, especially in cultures where maybe we don't have as good a food safety,
exactly,
and where you need those safety mechanisms. I actually had anecdotal, but I actually, one of my best friends, first of all, full disclosure, I have no interest in ever having any babies. So this is, I keep saying we.
Maybe we need to talk to discuss that.
Yeah, we should actually. I think that'd be really interesting. Why is it that some women don't have that itch? But one of my very best friends had just the worst pregnancy sickness I had ever seen, to the extent that there was, I mean, at times questions about whether actually smoking a little bit of pot outweighed the risk because she couldn't keep food down.
Wow.
You know what I mean? It was very bad. And I remember her visiting me one time in LA, and I was eating a bowl of like SpaghettiOs randomly. And she goes, "Oh, that smells so good." And I was like, "Eat it." You know, like anytime she showed any interest in food, you'd be like, "No, put it in your gullet. It's good."
And hopefully the child turned out to be very
healthy.
Yeah, the kid's
great.
Great.
There you go. Yeah, he's totally healthy.
There you go.
He's a wonderful little boy. So interesting. Very. And of course, the problem, maybe not the problem, but one of the potential negative implications, it seems like to me, of speaking in these global truths when it comes to evolutionary psychology is that human beings aren't very good. There's probably an evolutionary reason for this. We're not very good at understanding trends or at understanding risk. We're really good at thinking in terms of individuals and anecdotes. So you say, yeah, but my friend puked all the time and her baby has Down syndrome.
Fantastic point. And I actually make that exact point in details in a paper that I have forthcoming.
Interesting.
I actually argue exactly what you said, that in a sense, it's very difficult to get most people to jump on the Darwinian bandwagon, because we've evolved the capacity to succumb to cognitive and affective obstacles to the evolutionary narrative.
Yeah. Ooh, that's so meta.
Yes, isn't it incredible? It's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
So I'll give you a very specific instantiation of what you just said. So if you walk into a lecture and say, men are on average taller than women, that is an absolute biological fact.
Mm-hmm.
But every single woman who plays in the WNBA is taller than most men who are alive. The second part of that statement did not invalidate the first part.
Yeah.
Precisely because people don't understand statistical averages, don't understand that something that holds true at the population level doesn't mean that you invalidate it with a datum. But precisely because of our desire to view the world through our sort of personal lens, what do you mean that men would prefer to mate with younger women? My Uncle Joe is dating Aunt Linda and she's 10 years older. So there goes your Darwinian edifice, smart boy.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's an endless ability to generate these supposed singular violations that are hardly that, but people think that they have, you know, killed Darwin.
Yeah, because in the grand scheme of things, it really is a very small percentage. It's a long tail on this
exactly.
curve. And I think that's also an important argument for, I remember struggling with this when I was young, when I was struggling with mental illness and I was struggling with my depression and dealing with it and thinking, I just want to be normal. And really kind of taking stats classes early in psychology and realizing one day that no one person is fully normal.
Right.
If you look at every single measurable, you know, behavior or personality trait, you might on average be within the normal
right.
portion of a bell curve, but everybody has a constellation of traits. So a perfectly normal person would actually probably be quite boring, wouldn't they?
Probably.
It's probably those aberrations that make people so interesting.
True.
And we really are a constellation of probably it would be impossible to even make a table of every trait that a human could possess.
Right.
I'm sure that there are scientists who have tried
right,
it.
Right, right. But so kind of jump off that point, there's an interesting idea or observation that if you look at most traits, they really follow an inverted U-shape. And that, for example, perfectionism, right? If you don't have enough of it, then you don't care about the quality of your work. You don't double check things.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you're too perfectionist, you, and I think you were talking about everybody having some flaw. I think I tend to fall on the extreme pathological perfectionist, which is very nice as a scientist because I try to make sure that everything is right.
We're probably not amazing in your personal life.
Well, you'll have to ask my wife that.
Yeah.
But you know, it also stunts your productivity because if I have to check 84,000 times to make sure that I don't have one comma out of place. Well, the reality is that even if one comma were out of place, so what? I could have spent that time not triple checking things and maybe moving on to the next paper.
Yeah.
And so there's this inverted U relationship whereby there's some happy medium, right? So sort of what your grandmother would tell you, that everything in moderation, it certainly applies to a lot of psychological traits.
Yeah, I think that this is the age-old story of the, you know, clinical psych grad student or the psychiatry medical student first reading the DSM and being like, I have everything in here. And it's like, yes, because we all do to a very slight extent.
Right.
It's only when it becomes, you know, increasingly problematic and makes it you unable to get through your day that it's clinical.
Right.
But of course, we've all been paranoid. Of course, we've all had, you know, disorganized thoughts. We've all experienced depression, anxiety, all of those things.
Yeah.
And kind of knowing where you are on the spectrum can be difficult for a lot of people. I think this is a big problem with stigma in our culture about psychiatric illness. So many people are so... It's so difficult, again, to understand the concept of global, I guess, normalcy, cultural normalcy,
right.
What is aberrant and what is, you know, according to what the shrink says and what the media says and where do I fall on that scale? I don't even know how healthy it is to think that way. But I feel like there's this, I think that there's this point for a lot of people who struggle with mental illness where they realize, oh, I don't have to feel like this all the time. This is not what everybody else feels
right.
like. Because we're so, like you said, we have this adaptive mechanism that the world does unto us as it does unto everybody.
Right.
We can only see through our own eyes. Even the concept of empathy, I feel like I was just saying this on another show. Even the idea of being empathetic is selfish in its core, because how you be empathetic is you try to put yourself in their shoes.
Right. Well, certainly altruism has this self, right? When you think of altruism, you think of it as being defined as something that you're doing for someone else. But a central feature of altruism is reciprocity.
Uh-huh.
And so when I scratch your back, metaphorically, I am expecting the fact that later, when I need to be scratched, you will do onto me as I did onto you. And so, for example, social grooming for many primates is really exactly that. And so in some of my work, which I apply to consumer behavior, I look at, say, for example, gift giving as a way by which you instantiate altruism, right? So I invite Kara on her birthday with the expectation that when my birthday comes around, you'll remember and invite me. From a strict sort of utilitarian economic, homo economicus perspective, we could just skip this whole ritual because we're going to end up at the same place. I'm going to spend $50 on your dinner. You're going to reciprocate. But the reality is that just oiling, the reciprocity oils our bond.
Yeah.
And you see that in many social species.
And I think even beyond that, if you go one step further and you try at least to define altruism as something, let's say, let's throw the reciprocity out the window. Here's an example. My sister is a beautiful, wonderful woman who struggles in life in a lot of aspects. She struggles. And so every so often I want to do something for her. I know I'm not going to get it back. But what I do get back is feeling better about myself.
Right.
You know, there's always still a very positive experience that we have that if doing something for her, knowing I didn't get it in return and knowing that she would somehow make me feel bad about it every time, I probably wouldn't do it.
Right.
But because she's so grateful and because I feel like, oh, wasn't that hard for me? And I got to really help somebody.
Right.
What a good feeling.
Right.
That's why we do it.
Absolutely. And there's actually another type of altruism mm-hmm. where you, in a sense, signal the fact that you don't expect reciprocity. Hmm. It's a form of competitive altruism, right?
How funny.
Right. So you know, we're strategic, duplicitous, complicated creatures. Uh-huh. And so even the thing that you think is so pure in terms of our altruism oftentimes has ulterior motives.
When you look into this kind of gift-giving paradigm that you've been researching, I've seen that you have some papers on this. Do you ever go outside of, I mean, I know that one of the tenets of evolutionary psychology is to look at things cross-culturally.
Yes.
Do you ever look at the balance or the difference between what we think of as traditionally Western kind of individualistic societies and the more Eastern collectivist societies?
Yeah, I have done that. Both formally and anecdotally mm-hmm. through lived experience. So, and let me start with the latter. So I come from Lebanon, which is, it mimics sort of the environments in which we've evolved much more than sort of the anonymity of LA, right? I mean, the village where you're mm-hmm. born in Lebanon is likely where you might die, is where you're going to find your mate and so on, right?
Sure.
There's smaller social networks. And so when I moved to Canada, I was 11 when I moved to Canada. We escaped the Lebanese Civil War. My cultural upbringing was that, when you go out, it's very, very bad. It's gauche to count who ordered what, and $14.33, and you spend right. As a matter of fact, you should be the first to try to pay for everybody. And even if, frankly, you don't want to pay because you paid the last three times, you have to put on a whole ritual of I don't accept. You offended me. You offended my honor. You offended my family. Mm-hmm. So there's this whole sort of Arabic ritual that goes with sort of the honor. In Arabic, you say sharaf, this honor of being, generous to everybody. Now, that's in the context of Lebanon. Then you move to Montreal, Canada, where people don't necessarily hold those particular views, and you quickly find out that you're always winning at having the honor of being the one who pays.
Yeah, they're like, thanks, man.
Hey, man, wow, you're such... It's always nice to go out with Gad. He always gets to his wallet first. And so I very, very quickly adapted to the new environment. Otherwise, I would have been broke.
Broke, yeah, really quickly.
And so that would be an example where you're taking some of these sort of gift-giving or mm-hmm. generous behaviors, and you recognize that they're not modulated in quite the same way across cultures.
Yeah, they're definitely culturally bound. And they also, there's almost something that goes beyond just the act of gift-giving. There's something much deeper, like you said. Competitiveness in general is very different across cultures. I remember a study, it was probably an evolutionary psychology study, and I'm totally not going to cite it correctly here, but something about students were taking some sort of a test where they, first it was like a test of skills, I don't know, an IQ test or something, and then they also took some sort of questionnaire where they had to say, I believe that I am better than average, worse than average, or about the same as average in this skill set. And they compared kind of Western American students to Eastern, I guess, Chinese students. And like on average, the Chinese students did better, but said that they thought they did worse.
Right.
You know, and this is very American, right?
Right.
To be like, I'm awesome.
Right.
There, it's so competitive here. We're raised to be competitive. We're raised to do competitive sports. The idea of sharing and of working together, it's important, but it definitely takes a back seat to that manifest destiny, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, kind of social mobility narrative. And I'll be honest, it really is a narrative here more than it's an actuality. And it's interesting to see how that comes across in so many ways. You know, we don't, our elderly parents don't live with us here.
Right.
We just, that's weird. Nobody, I mean, some people do it, but they're like, ugh, I just kind of have to do this. Whereas in Eastern cultures, it's unheard of to not have multiple generations in the same home.
Great personal anecdote, which kind of speaks to this. And then I could talk some more about cross-cultural issues with gift giving, if you like.
Sure.
So when I finished my PhD, I came back to Montreal, where my parents lived. And even though at that point I was in my late 20s, and so I didn't foresee living with my parents as a young assistant professor, to my parents, it was unthinkable that since I wasn't married, that I wouldn't be going back home. It's it's an insult to them and so on. So for the next maybe 8 or 9 months after I finished my PhD, I lived with them. And I quickly realized that it was not how I wanted my life to unfold as much as I loved my parents. And so I remember one day I went down to the basement. My mother was sitting in the basement early in the morning, and I was going to have the talk with her. The talk being that I'm leaving mom.
Yeah.
And I remember she looked at me, and it was really quite a humorous moment, because typically you might think of this where you're going to come out that you're, you know, gay or, right? Well, I was coming out that I was no longer going to live there. And without me saying many words, she just broke out crying because to her, from the cultural background that we come from, if you're not married, you should stay at home. And that clashed perhaps with my personality, but also with sort of the culture that I had been acclimatized to, which says that you get out there. You
and
don't
for
stay.
Her, it was probably a rejection.
It was a rejection, yeah, exactly.
A hurtful.
Yeah.
I had a similar experience when I told my mom, probably we can't talk on the phone every day. I think some people,
I need boundaries, Mom.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Probably every day. We're saying the same thing. What's new? Not a lot. Oh, how boring. The same conversation.
Right.
But yeah, that's very interesting. And I think it's a cultural study in and of itself of what happens when your first generation, second generation kids start to acclimate to their new culture and mom and dad are trying to hold on to something.
Right.
You know, I think you see that quite a lot in America. It really is a melting pot. But because of that, we all melt into each other.
Right.
You can try your best to live in, you know, only an Armenian neighborhood, only, you know, a Japanese neighborhood. It might work for the first settlers, but
as you said, acclimate. I just remembered that I might have said acclimatize. Now, is acclimatize the word, or did I just make up that word?
I'm not sure. I think acclimate would.
Okay. Well, if it's not a word, either give me credit for coining it, or my apologies for mispronouncing it.
I do like it though. I just figured it was one of those things. I was like, his accent's different. You know, whatever. Oh, that's too funny. Yeah, it's definitely fascinating to think of all of the different ways. I had a weird thought experiment in my own head once that I'm not sure how comfortable I am or will be even talking about it on air, because I don't want to come off as insensitive. But I've often wondered, when we look at those cultural differences between the Western competitiveness and the more Eastern collectivist mentality, and maybe this doesn't really apply in this situation at all, but you think about big historical events, you think about different forms of government and why governmental structures hold with certain people more than others hold with other people. I've often wondered about World War II and about fascism and about the Holocaust and about some of the very, you know, just horrible things that happened during that era, specifically in Germany, but also in Italy and then spreading to the countries around them. Would those things have happened if they had nucleated in a different culture, if they had nucleated in another place?
Well,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If America already had its governmental structure in place and we elected somebody similar to a Hitler person, would he have been able to strategize the way he did in Germany, gain power and start to, and obviously there's all sorts of other things around it. We're on a big island really far away from other countries, but I don't know, always really, you know, North Korea and South Korea, almost the same people, such different governments and cultures.
Pakistan and India.
Exactly. Israel and Palestine.
That's right.
You know, literally almost indistinguishable in terms of blood, in terms of certain cultures. Sometimes, obviously, there are major religious differences right. between the groups. But outside of that...
Yeah. So I'm not sure if I could sort of answer your thought mm-hmm. experiment. There are too many factors that come sure. into play. But to speak of sort of different cultural traditions, I'll again share a personal anecdote. So we often hear about sort of the phenomenal success of Jews. Mm-hmm. By the way, I'm Lebanese Jewish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's like kind of a sort of a joke, a half joke that you hear a lot of times that Jews are good with money or Jews.
Right.
Are, yeah, exactly.
But although there are sort of objective metrics in terms of how, you know, how many Nobel Prizes have Jews won as a function of the number of Jews that exist in the world, and it's pretty impressive.
And I've also heard some kind of historical explanations for the fact that, like, you know, when Jews couldn't hold certain jobs and they became
bankers.
They would
go into, exactly.
And, yeah.
So there is mm-hmm. there are these types of arguments. So from a personal anecdote perspective, to show you how different upbringings, despite your sort of genetic endowment, mm-hmm. culture does matter. And I'm saying this as an evolutionist. Nobody denies the fact that culture and environments matter. So I remember after I finished my MBA, I have a brother who lives in Southern California, and I had been accepted to several doctoral programs, mm-hmm. one of which was UC Irvine. And so I had come out here to Southern California to see if I wanted to enroll at UC Irvine. I ended up not enrolling here. And he had said, well, why don't you come and hang out with me at work? Maybe after your MBA, you want to take a break from studying, maybe put on this proverbial suit, and then you could go back to mm-hmm. academia. And when my mother caught wind of the fact that I might potentially not go on to pursue my PhD, when I returned to Montreal, she sort of took me to the side room and said, son, I hear that you might not go on for your PhD. Do you want people to remember you as somebody who dropped out of school?
Like
I had an MBA. Yeah. I would be a dropout, yeah. right? And so that's the standard that... Now, of course, I didn't pursue a PhD to please her. It was something that I mean, I don't think she knew what a PhD was when I wanted to pursue one. Mm-hmm. But it shows you the type of inculcation that happens. And then some other kid who might have the same abilities as me, who didn't grow up in an environment where you have these types of exacting standards, may not turn out to be as successful. So, mm-hmm. and I mentioned the story because I think it's really important for people to understand that evolutionary psychologists don't reject the importance of the environment.
Yeah.
If anything, most evolutionists perfectly recognize that much of who we are is an inextricable mix of both our innateness and our environment.
And also that those things, I mean, we're starting to understand more and more as I think neuroscience develops and grows. You know, we have a pretty good understanding at this point of what happens at the cellular level. We have right. a pretty good understanding of what happens at the like holistic structural level, this lobe, this area, this Broca's area, whatever. We're starting to get more and more entrenched in network level neuroscience and understanding how plastic our brains are,
right.
how, you know, both evolution and the environment then in turn actually affect our brain structure, which then affects our ability to interact
Mind
with our
blown.
Environment. It's just, it's right. almost, like you said, inextricable.
Yeah.
You know, it's we talk about this all the time with depression. Depression is a great example. So many people think of depression as a disease of will. They think of it as something that you can just think
pull up
yourself.
Your socks.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you say, no, I mean, there are brain differences, both neurochemical, but also structural. And whether those brain differences are congenital or not, certain behaviors are really burning them in.
Right.
And it takes so much more work to kind of be plastic out of a structure that
right.
you're so used to,
right.
you know, it's like cycle of abuse stuff. Kids who grew up experiencing very heavy trauma and abuse often, you know, have those traits later on. And it's, yeah, they weren't born as abused children. It was a very, you know, environmental thing, but it affects their neurology.
Absolutely.
And yeah, it's just way more complicated than we want it to be. You know, people talk about nature versus nurture.
Exactly.
It's not a versus.
Yeah, exactly.
It's together.
Right.
It's so dumb. It's like, is this nature or nurture? It's both. The answer is always it's both, you guys.
So true. But going back to mental illness and culture, mm-hmm. I could again link it to sort of my personal background. In the context of the Middle East, mm-hmm. To admit that you have a mental illness is in a culture of honor and shame, it's dreadful. I mean, the whole idea of going to a stranger called a therapist mm-hmm. and to publicly, I mean, even though it's private, but you're at least admitting to him or her, your your insecurities, your flaws, your is outlandish, right?
Yeah.
And so that I find is a very interesting difference in terms, a cultural difference in terms of how you navigate through the stigma of depression. So I have in my own family people who've suffered from depression. And my family, I mean my nuclear family, not my wife and so on. So my siblings and so on. And the general attitude is, I mean, roll up your sleeves, and this is all make believe, right? It's because you're maybe weak.
Yeah. See, I thought it was bad in Texas. It's probably much worse, you know, in these cultures.
Of course.
Yeah.
It's cultures of honor. You never admit to flaws, whether it be at the individual level or at the societal level, right? I mean, this is maybe this is a too much of a jumping point, but why do the Turks not admit to the Armenian genocide?
Because it's a failure.
It is an attack on their honor. Yeah. As a matter of fact, there is a law where if you write about the Armenian genocide, you're attacking, I mean, literally Turkish honor. And so there's a real interesting pathology that develops when you're navigating through these types of issues of honor and shame.
You even see it. I mean, even in this culture, you see sometimes the government going to great lengths to legislate away basically mistakes that they've made.
Right.
You see it a lot of times where a very powerful figure or a group of people make a mistake, and instead of just owning up to it and admitting to it and righting the wrong, they'll kind of go through all of these. It's so obvious to everybody from the outside, but they're going through all of these hoops to kind of, you know, walk away from the shame that comes along with just being wrong. Like, that was a Bushism, like no apologies.
Right.
Like, are you kidding me? That is not the way to lead.
Right.
Admit when you're wrong, but it's very hard for people to do. I think in any culture, there probably is an evolutionary kind of defend your honor, even if you totally fucked up.
And think about the seven deadly sins, which are very much enshrined in moral theology and moral philosophy, right?
Yeah, regardless of the religion, you kind of see them popping up.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, you may or may not know this, that if you were to construct a hierarchy of the seven deadly sins, you know which is the one that is at the root of all others?
Greed?
Pride.
Pride, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Which speaks to you know, being too proudful. Mm-hmm. Proudful, is that a word?
Prideful.
Prideful.
Too proud or too prideful.
Thank you.
Both of those work.
Yeah. Too prideful to admit to your faults, right?
Yeah.
Now, the reason why it is the sort of the apex predator of the seven deadly sins is because the argument goes that in the theological context, all the other sins stem from too much self-love, right? If I don't have I don't have enough in me to love God, and therefore I succumb to lust and greed and wrath and envy. So being prideful is an innate part of humans.
It is, and it's not necessarily, quote-unquote, something that's bad. It's something that we need to understand so that we can control it, so we can harness it. So that, you know, a lot of those things, I mean, we have, whether you want to look at them from a moralistic perspective or religious perspective or just a pure philosophical kind of scientific perspective, there are a lot of things in us that just are.
Right.
You know, and so my stance as a more liberal thinker has been always to accept and understand what it means to just have experiences and feelings and behaviors and figure out how they affect us in our daily lives. Okay, so some people are gay.
Right.
They just are that way.
Right.
And I think if it's fundamental to the human experience, how could it be bad?
Right.
You know, how could we put these like negative value judgments on them? A lot of times it's about trying to fit some sort of narrative.
Right. I was once at a giving a talk at APA, American Psychological Association, and I was taking the bus to the venue, a conference bus. And so a graduate student comes up to me and introduces herself to me and asks me, oh, as an evolutionist, are there any explanations for homosexuality?
Mm-hmm.
And so I gave her sort of a tentative explanation because it's not quite clear that there's a definitive argument, an adaptive argument.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was explaining these things, a gentleman who I guess was overhearing us, who was at the conference, stopped and introduced himself and said that he's a clinician who helps people out of their gayness
How long ago was this?
2008.
Oh my God. Because didn't the APA like years ago be like, that's not legitimate therapy?
73, I think.
Yeah. They're kind of on it. You
know? And in his case, he was a Jewish fellow. Mm-hmm. It was through the study of the Talmud and the, I don't know, the Old Testament.
I have a bit of a problem, I have to say, with like religious therapy. That's just me. But I'm also
so you can't pray the gay away, apparently?
Yeah, it fucking pisses me off, to be honest. Anyway, go on.
Right. No, but so this guy was shocked that I was using all this quote science when it's clear that simply by sort of navigating through the Talmud and through the Old Testament, you can absolutely get out of all that.
Oh, that's now, so sad.
Interestingly, by the way, and we may or may not want to get into this, if I tell the story where I'm being critical of some sort of Jewish approach, then I won't get blowback. If I were to criticize some hick religious Christian Republican senator, no blowback. But can you think of a religion where if I were to criticize it, it would be really gauche of me to do so?
Oh, I criticize Islam all the time.
Do not.
I mean, not that they're not different. They're very different, but they're all the same root.
Right.
It's just, I think it's historically different time periods. You know, there were times when Christianity was equally as insane as fundamentalist Islam is now.
Right.
And don't get me wrong, fundamentalist Christianity is horrible and insane, but it's a bit, not apples and oranges, but apples and like rotten apples. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like we're kind of beyond the dark ages.
Right.
But there are cultures that aren't.
Right. But, you know, we talked about this actually earlier. I was on the Dave Rubin show report, and we were talking about sort of the blind spot of the progressive mindset. And it's just astonishing because as an academic, I see it day in and day out. Most academics are perfectly comfortable and feel that it's part of their sort of progressive card-carrying membership to criticize religion very forcefully, except one religion.
Except Islam. And I think you also see it too. You see a couple places. I know Dave has talked about this quite a bit, where it used to be that it was okay to be Zionistic. And now as a more liberal person, a progressive person, you have to kind of be defensive of Palestine.
Right.
And that's a big issue for him because he's, of course, Jewish and he defends that a lot. For me, it's one of those, I don't have skin in either game.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I can kind of look at it as balanced as possible. And it's still so freaking complicated that it's hard for me to have an opinion. But I definitely feel like, you know, when it comes to religion, not that I'm totally anti-religion, I'm an atheist. I don't see a whole lot of good that religion does that you can't boil down to underpinnings, like cultural underpinnings.
Right.
Like people say, oh, but people who are religious lead longer, healthier lives. It's like, yeah, people who like go to play bridge with their friends do that too.
Yeah, because it's communal.
Yeah, it's society. Yeah, exactly. It's you have friends and stuff, and like atheists don't go to church.
Well, David Sloan Wilson, who's a very famous evolutionary biologist and a group selectionist, he wrote a book in 2002 called Darwin's Cathedral, where he argued for the adaptive value of religion using a group selectionist argument. Precisely by demonstrating that groups who are religious are more communal, more cohesive, and hence it leads to adaptive outcomes more so than groups that are non-religious. And so that's probably the most compelling adaptive argument for why religion exists. In my case, in one of my books, my trade book in 2011, I have a chapter which shockingly titled Marketing Hope by Selling Lies. And of course, I argue that the greatest peddler of hope is religion, precisely because it caters. And I mean, it might seem obvious, but I think, you know, it's worth making the point that, you know, if I have a high cholesterol level, I go see my physician, he prescribes Lipitor, and I'm good to go. Well, there is no pill for this problem called mortality.
Yep.
But there, if you come to church on Sunday, I can give you a pill where you could be reunited with Aunt Jenny and you could see Waldo again. And so religion really can't go away in some sense, because for most people, the idea that we are on a very ephemeral journey is not a pleasant one. So in a sense, I think it takes somebody to be pathologically honest, maladaptively honest, to be an atheist, because it's a lot more comforting to be religious.
It is. But the funny thing is, just like, you know, so somebody's gay, they just are that way. This is something I talk about all the time when I do atheist advocacy. I tried to believe and I couldn't.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There are some people who, no matter what, you can't convince yourself that that thing is true. I was raised Mormon. I grew up in it. My parents still are. It was a huge part of my upbringing. But at 15, I couldn't do it anymore. It was like, I'm lying to myself.
Do you know a particular, was there an epiphany or was it just sort of incremental?
It was incremental, okay. Very much. And for me, I was just talking about this with Stephen Novella on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. Some people, I think, reject God first and then find science. Some people find science first and it helps them in their process of rejecting God. For me, I was very much an atheist before I was a scientist, which is kind of bizarre. It's a little bit of a different
route.
Yeah. But, you know, I think maybe this is a personality trait for some people that are just more rebellious. They just, you know,
I think actually you're exactly right. Mm-hmm. I remember being very, very young. I mean, I have memories as early back as I can access memories where I would sit in synagogue. This is growing up in Lebanon, and where, you know, my father would, okay, now we stand up, now we sit down, now we do the Macarena to the left, now we do the sun. And I'd always say, what do we, just shut up and do.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what the? Explain to me, feed me knowledge. And so I can literally go back to being maybe 5 or 6 and being quite annoyed at the fact that you weren't providing me with compelling answers. Now, I wasn't asking big metaphysical questions. I was asking, why do we now have to stand up? And when can I sit down? and the answer was just copy.
Just do it. Yeah.
Just do
and,
it.
And that's the same kind of rhetoric that you hear on the Christian side, which is always God works in mysterious
exactly.
ways. You know, it's like it's all fluff, which is why I've said this before, which is why I think that a lot of I think that Mormonism specifically is very comforting to a lot of people because it's batshit crazy, but the reason it's batshit crazy is they've come up with answers to all those little questions.
Right.
And so as you go, but how could Jesus and God and the Holy Ghost be the same? You can't give birth to yourself. I'm very confused. And then Mormons go, oh, it's not. It's actually 3 different individuals that are all flesh and blood. And you're like, oh, okay, I buy it. You know, and eventually you get more and more into the lore. And it's like Scientology, you know.
Incredible.
It's like, oh, okay, I guess I get my own planet. If I'm a man, by the way, cool.
Are you going to tell me, are you going to explain to me the whole underwear story?
The underwear story, I don't even know the story because I never got old enough to do it. But married people who are sealed in the temple, they wear the magic underwear and they call them garments. And I think part of it is about propriety. Like part of it is about making sure that you dress modestly, quote unquote.
It applies to both men and women?
Both men and women wear them. And they're like short sleeve, netty, like netted t-shirts and these shorts that come down to your knees. So it basically is that you don't want your garments to show because it then means that you're dressing modestly. And there's also this weird thing about how it's like creepy. It's like the first thing that touches you, like God touches you before anybody else.
Oh,
yeah, I don't like it. makes me have the weird feels. But anyway, I have to say, because we're running low on time, your wife will be here soon.
Really? Okay.
Yes, isn't that crazy? We haven't even really talked about the whole marketing side of what
we
you
have
do,
not.
Which is, you know, decision making. How do I sell people things? Or I mean, what specifically is your research focus?
Yeah, so basically I look at the biological and evolutionary underpinnings of consumer behavior.
Okay.
So while most consumer psychologists would study all sorts of wonderful things without ever infusing a biological lens into the story, I do exactly that. So example, I could give you as many as time permits.
Mm-hmm.
So if I want to look at what happens to women's consumer behavior as a function of where they are in their menstrual cycle.
Ooh.
Right? Well, there you go.
And it really does have an effect?
A huge effect.
I do cry more at commercials when I'm on my period.
Ah, there you go. right. But how about, can you think of any consumer-related phenomena that you might engage in more or less depending on where you are in your...
Chocolate.
You eat more chocolate,
buy more chocolate
when you're in the luteal, when you're in the non-fertile phase or the fertile phase?
It's hard for me to say because I'm on birth control.
So
women are on birth control now.
So that screws it up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It totally screws it up because when I'm actually, quote, menstruating, my body thinks I'm pregnant. No, when I'm not menstruating, my body thinks I'm pregnant.
So here's what we did. So this was a study that I published a few years ago with one of my former doctoral students.
Mm-hmm.
We kept track of women's behaviors, preferences, desires across 35 contiguous days, precisely because the average menstrual cycle is about 28 days.
Mm-hmm.
And so by going an extra week, you're pretty much covering most of the natural variance across women. And we in this data collection, we looked at many, many things. But for this particular study, we looked at beautification and food-related consumption.
Sure.
So to To put very simply, when women are in their non-fertile phase of their menstrual cycle, they're much more interested in food. When they are in the fertile phase, this is when they beautify more, right? So you could imagine different Darwinian pulls becoming more active depending on where you are in your menstrual cycle. Now, I couldn't have even thought of that particular research question or proposed specific hypotheses were I not coming from an evolutionary lens, yeah, or certainly a physiological lens. I've done studies where I've looked at how conspicuous consumption, men's conspicuous consumption, how that affects their testosterone levels.
What is conspicuous consumption?
Conspicuous, showing off, it's peacocking.
Gotcha.
So I get my Maserati and yeah, I make sure that when I'm driving on Melrose, all the girls see mm-hmm. that I'm, and I blast the music, watch my peacock, right?
And does that have to do with more or less testosterone?
Right. So what we basically did in this particular study, with mm-hmm. this was with another graduate student, is we brought in young males to the lab, and we had them drive a Porsche, which mm-hmm. we actually rented, or a beaten up old sedan, downtown Montreal, where everybody could see you, public environment, there's an audience, or in a semi-deserted highway. And after each driving condition, we took salivary assays so that we could then measure the testosterone. And as you may predict at this point, you put young males in a Porsche, their testosterone blows up. Because what it's basically doing is it's imbuing you with immediate social status. Mm-hmm. If you look across the animal kingdom, where typically males fight for access to women, to females, the winner will have a rise in testosterone mm-hmm. and the loser will have a drop. And so I took this idea and said, well, surely this must manifest itself in the consumer setting. And so basically what I do throughout all my work, those are two of the sort of classic examples I give because they're so palatable to most people.
And they're so understandable. Yep, I buy it.
Exactly. And it's difficult, by the way, for the social constructivists to argue that it's due to learning.
Yeah.
Because the dependent variables are physiological based.
They're hormonal.
They're hormonal. Yeah. That it makes it a lot more difficult for people. Oh, it's due to learning. It's due to culture. And so, you know, I did another. Do we have any time? We're okay?
Yeah. We're good. Okay. Yeah, a couple minutes.
Okay. So I did another study. You were talking earlier about cross-cultural issues and mm-hmm. gift giving. So this is an ongoing. It's not yet published. We looked at gift giving at Israeli weddings with three Israeli colleagues of mine, and we specifically wanted to look at two things in the study. Number one, does the size of the monetary gift correlate with the genetic relatedness between the giver and the bride and groom? Hmm. The idea being that the closer the genetic link, you modulate the size of your gift. So
yeah, so mom and dad give more money, brother and sister give more money.
Than second cousins.
Sure.
Now that, you could say, well, of course it has a genetic underpinning, but most people could have predicted this even if they knew nothing about evolutionary theory.
Yeah, because it could be cultural, right?
Or at least there's proximity,
sure,
right, familiarity.
Yeah.
Fine. The second hypothesis that we tested, you could not have come up with were you not coming from an evolutionary perspective. So there's something called differential grandparental solicitude. So if you look at, yeah, I know it's a big fancy
differential
word.
Differential grandparental solicitude.
Solicitude.
Okay.
This is the guy who misspoke and said proudful instead of prideful. See, my perfection now has got me all bothered by it.
It happens. I find in my aphasia, I can never think of very easy words, but I can always come up with words like aphasia.
Aphasia, right. So if you look at your four grandparents, mm-hmm. They all share on average a quarter of their genes with you. Mm-hmm. So if the issue were simply one of genetic relatedness, then you would hypothesize that all your four grandparents should equally invest in you. If you then add a second component to the mix, known as genetic assuredness, how assured are you of your genetic link? Well, your maternal grandmother is fully assured. She has two generations of maternal lineage. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing as maternity uncertainty. Mm-hmm. Your paternal grandfather has two generations of paternity uncertainty.
Yeah.
So we would expect the maternal grandmother to invest the most, the paternal grandfather to invest the least, and the two other grandparents to invest somewhere in the middle. And that's what's been found in many studies. And so what we did is we took that idea and said, well, could we now test whether the maternal side of the bride and groom, irrespective of which kin they are, just mm-hmm. the maternal side will invest more than the paternal side. And that's exactly what we found. Now, you could have never hypothesized this were you not aware of all the things that I just mentioned. I mean, there's no way you could generate that hypothesis.
Yeah, it sounds almost random.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah,
right.
It's like, so why would they, you know, if you looked at just the data
exactly
without
right.
knowing the question, you'd be like, why am I seeing this weird trend?
Exactly right. And so those are the types of things that I study. I look for the biological and Darwinian drivers of consumer mm-hmm. behavior.
Interesting. Well, on that note, because we are running low on time and I want to get you back to your family, I close every episode with the same two questions.
Okay.
And so I want to ask you those as well. The first one is kind of the bummer question. So we end on a higher note.
I'm nervous now.
They're big picture questions too. I'm kind of a jerk for asking people this. But I want to know if in whatever context that matters to you, whether it's very personal or global, when you look to the future, what is the thing that makes you most concerned, that keeps you up most at night, you know, that worries you?
That's the question.
And then on the flip side of that is the flip side. What are you looking forward to the most? What are you most optimistic about?
So the first, the more somber one.
Yeah, I don't like to end on a bummer. Right,
right. So the somber one, it's seeing the West being very permissive about totalitarian religious ideologies that are incongruent with Western liberal values.
Mm-hmm.
As somebody who comes from a environment where I escaped these types of ideologies, anybody is welcomed in the West as long as they fully abide by our Western liberal values. Guys like me could escape the hellholes that I come from precisely because there's a place called Canada and the United States. And now I'm seeing that these places, which are sort of the last resting stops for people like me, are being slowly eroded by a whole slew of forces: political correctness, moral relativism, cultural relativism, and so on and so forth, thought police. And so one of the things that really worries me is the fact that the West doesn't really have the stomach to stand up for the wonderful societies, the best societies that the world has ever known. Are they perfect? Absolutely not. Are there things that we can improve in the West? Absolutely yes. But is there a place where I would rather live? No. And so that's what, and it worries me, frankly, not so much for me. It worries me for the two children that you saw in my car.
Sure.
who will suffer from the brunt of the stupidity of the West if we don't get our act together. So that's, how's that for an answer?
I think that's a great answer. And I think it's even, I mean, it goes even deeper. Like, you know this. We're feeding these cultures. We're angering them, and at the same time not living up to what we're making them angry about.
Right.
It's infuriating. You know, we have this rhetoric of like, we're America and they hate us for our freedom, but then we aren't even embracing those freedoms
right.
the way that we should be.
True.
I love that, and I completely agree, and I think that you're the first person who has made that point on the show.
Well, thank
it's
you.
It's always global.
Well, usually the in Miss America, isn't it? I want to bring peace.
And yeah, so, it's peace. Right, you're peace, right. It's so, peace. But now we're like, the Earth is getting hotter.
What's the thing that I most I'm hopeful for?
Yeah.
Well, I wake up every day very happy because I love my work. I love discussing ideas. This is why I come on your show, because any time I have a forum where I could propagate memes, discuss memes, I'm there. So in a sense, I look to my children and hopefully I will give them a world where they can grow up in a safer place than the world that I came from. So I guess looking at my children's eyes, the hope that I have.
I love it. Oh, it's beautiful.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. Before you go and reunite with your lovely wife and children and go have a wonderful dinner here in LA, let everybody know where they can find you in social media, where they can watch, because you have a YouTube series as well.
I do.
Yeah.
Thank you for asking.
So point everybody to those places.
So if they want to follow me on Twitter, it's at Gadsaad, G-A-D-S-A-A-D. My YouTube channel is basically youtube.com/c/Gadsaad. Each clip is called The Sad Truth. And so we're up to Sad Truth 52. So you've got about 52 clips to catch up on.
Nice.
And then they could also follow me on my public Facebook page, Dr.Gad.Sad.
Perfect. All right, guys, check him out. Read about his work, both the kind of journal articles, but also the more popular science that he is writing and disseminating. I think it's so important. Every time I meet a scientist who's also a science communicator, I'm feeling more and more hopeful for the future. So thank you for that. Thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And thanks for joining me. This was a really fun chat.
This was fun.
Yeah, yeah. All right. And everybody listening, thank you so much for tuning in week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.